This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Hurricane Irma carved a path of destruction up the Florida Peninsula, knocking out power, damaging roofs and toppling trees, and setting off destructive tornadoes. As of last week, the official death toll stood at 50, and that number could climb. For some reporters, this was their first experience covering a major hurricane. We're going to hear how two stations in the public radio network responded, first WGCU in Fort Myers. Well, Jessica Mazaros is a reporter and the host of All Things Considered at WGCU. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jessica, I'm looking at your Twitter feed here, and on the top there's a pinned tweet. 8 hours of live interviews, booking, editing, scrambling and informing through Hurricane Irma for Southwest Florida. We're now winding down, end quote. And you posted that a while ago, but does it feel like you're winding down? Because I know you've been doing a lot of post-storm coverage.
It still feels like we're still in the hurricane a little bit, but we are just now winding down. But yeah, that Sunday when the hurricane hit, we went wall to wall, which means we're live on the air until the hurricane passes. So we started at 1 p.m. and went on through a little after 8 p.m., all of us. Yep.
Was this your first wall to wall storm coverage?
It really was. I'm born and raised Floridian. This was not my first hurricane, but it was my first hurricane as a reporter. And it was a very eye-opening experience. You really know what you can do when you're under the gun, when you just adrenaline is going and you have live air and you have to fill it. It's a learning experience.
What was the wildest thing that you heard or saw during your coverage of Hurricane Irma?
Well, the wildest thing was the eye wall was actually going right over us while I was live on the air, and some of my colleagues informed me of that. So before I cut out of my time on the air, I said, you know, we'll be back with more updates. And as we know, right now, as I'm being told that the eye wall is over us right now, and then I cut out. And then we also had Rachel Iacovoni, one of our reporters in Collier County at the Emergency Operations Center, and she was live on the air being interviewed by Julie Glenn. We were all switching in and out to do live hosting as well as booking. But then we had a reporter at the EOC Emergency Operations Center in Collier, and we had another one, Quincy Walters, a reporter at the EOC in Lee County. So Rachel was in Collier, and she was live on the air on her phone as the eye wall was passing, and she saw the sun, and she got to say that on our air. It was kind of an amazing moment for our airwaves.
I know as a reporter you're supposed to kind of have this sense of detachment almost when you're reporting on things like this, but were you scared during the storm? Because as you say, the eye went right over you guys, the path was shifting around a lot, it was kind of hard to tell exactly where this enormous storm was going.
There was a moment on Sunday morning when we were having a meeting, all of the Florida public radio stations was on the line with our Florida Public Radio Emergency Network meteorologist Jeff Huffman, and he said, "Hey, Fort Myers, I'm sorry, I don't have good news for you. It looks like 10 to 15 feet of storm surge coming your way." And I remember four of us just looking up at each other in astonished and wondering what our fates were, but it never occurred to us to not be on the air and be there for our listeners and stick it out. But I do remember that sense of, wow, what does that mean? Will we have a hometown when we get out of this?
Mm-hmm. So what's it like for a station like GCU as a big storm bears down? It kind of becomes effectively a shelter for the staff, right?
It does. We actually decided Saturday morning before the hurricane winds picked up around here. Saturday morning, everyone would come here. Some brought their families, some brought their pets, and we just started working. But it was a shelter. As I understand it, it's up to a Category 2 hurricane standards. But it definitely worked for us. We have these great storm windows, and I didn't get to see the hurricane myself since I was in the studio, so I guess that's a good thing. That means that it really worked as a shelter, because I didn't feel any of the effects. I was kind of hunkered down in a studio during the whole thing as the eye wall was passing. That was just what somebody was telling me. So yeah, it became a shelter. It became one large family, I think, mm-hmm. with everyone here together.
So you've been doing plenty of reporting out and about, you know, in the aftermath, the cleanup, as people get power back, as they sort of rebuild their homes and businesses. What are you seeing out there? Who are some of the hardest hit communities?
The hardest hit communities were definitely in Everglades City. Most of the homes were totally destroyed with flooding. And it's a lot of them have nowhere to go. So we have our reporter, Rachel Iacovone, she did an initial story on that. She's going to be following up with them. It's really heartbreaking. There's also the farm worker town of Immokalee within Collier County, just near Naples, actually. And they were also very hard hit. There's a lot of mobile homes there that were destroyed. If you look further down in my Twitter feed, there's actually a mobile home that was completely in shambles. It almost looks like a tornado got to it because it's such an isolated event. But yeah, then definitely flooding and destruction hit Immokalee and Everglades City, I would say, the hardest.
And I understand the citrus industry has been pretty badly damaged too. Have you been out and about talking to some of the citrus growers and seeing what's going on with their groves?
I did. On the Monday after the storm, I spoke with Gene McAvoy, who's the vegetable extension agent in Hendry County for University of Florida. I spoke with him on the phone the day after the hurricane, and he just broke down crying during an interview because he said these are his friends. You know, it's not just citrus. It's citrus growers. It's tomato farmers, vegetable farmers. Hendry County was hit very hard by the storm, and flooding and trees uprooted, greenhouses collapsing. This is very costly for a lot of these farmers. So there's a lot of rebuilding that has to happen in that area in particular. So they're kind of hoping for state and federal funds to help foot the bill for this.
So what do you think, Jessica Mazars, the biggest challenge is going to be for Southwest Florida as these communities rebuild?
The biggest challenge is fear of the next hurricane, I think, because once you rebuild, I mean, we're seeing a lot of things, a lot of activity in the tropics, and it's kind of hard to wrap your head around, okay, we're rebuilding, but is something else coming toward us now? And just kind of preparing and staying prepared, and what can we do better, I think.
In a storm like this, when it impacts such a big swath of the community, how are you and the other staff doing as far as your homes and properties and things like that? Did you all make it through okay?
We all did make it through okay. We didn't have power for days, all of us. So we actually camped out in the newsroom for about 6 days, all of us. So post-hurricane, we were all sleeping in our offices on the floor, air mattresses, sleeping bags, and, made dinner. We had power here. So we all stayed here and continued to wake up in the morning and do coverage and come back here, finish our work. And then we stayed here at work. But we are all basically back to normal. Everything, thankfully, is all right with our homes. We didn't lose any lives and no significant damage, just a long-term power outage, I would say.
Well, Jessica Mazars is a reporter. She's the host of All Things Considered at WGCU. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
Hours after hitting South and Central Florida, Irma struck Jacksonville, inundating the city with the worst flooding Jacksonville had seen in a century. Ryan Bank is a reporter and host with WJCT in Jacksonville. Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So talk me through the coverage of this storm from your point of view. What was it like being in Jacksonville as Hurricane Irma barreled down on the city?
Well, I think in many ways it was kind of like it probably would have been for anyone in Florida covering this storm or anyone watching the news coverage of this storm. It was a lot of uncertainty all the way up to the lead up. It started off kind of feeling like Jacksonville was going to get another sideswipe, sort of like Hurricane Matthew last year, or that even worse, we would get a direct hit coming from the East Coast. When it appeared that that was not going to happen and it started moving westward, and as many people know, it was very difficult to try to evacuate within the state because of the uncertainty surrounding this direction. So it really wasn't until right before the storm crossed paths with Northeast Florida that it became real. And it was... it was the first storm, major storm like that that I've covered. I did help cover Matthew, but again, that sort of skirted the coast, and although it caused a lot of damage and did displace people on our East Coast, it was far less than the extensive damage that we saw from Irma.
Ryan, looking at some of the photographs of Jacksonville in the aftermath, and just sort of following the passage of the storm as it passed through that part of the state, it looked to me like a lot of what we were seeing was flooding. Was it a bad flooding event primarily?
I think primarily it was. The National Weather Service meteorologist who was embedded here in Jacksonville described the flooding at, you know, right as it was happening, as a once in 150 years type of rain event. Essentially, the last time that certain parts of Jacksonville and the downtown and urban core had seen flooding like this was in 1864. And the last time that we had seen a hurricane this powerful hit us this head on was in 1964 with Hurricane Dora. So definitely flooding was a major issue, and there are places in the Northeast Florida region, southwest of Jacksonville proper in Clay County and in Northwest Jacksonville that are still waiting for waters to recede. A lot of that has to do with high tide and the way that Northeast Florida is kind of surrounded and bisected by the St. Johns River and its tributaries. That being said, there was a lot of wind and there was a lot of damage to power lines, to transformers and generators, down trees. I think the mayor is, although we don't have an exact number right now as to what the damage will look like, the debris cleanup alone, most city officials are pretty certain is going to vastly outnumber the cost of debris cleanup during last year's Matthew.
So what does the city look like right now?
Well, you know, you go to certain areas and it's already starting to kind of look like it's back to normal. But then there are others like that I said that are still kind of reeling from this extra water, especially when the tide comes in. There are restaurants and bars and other kind of lively places in some of our neighborhoods, San Marco being one of them, and to a lesser extent, also Riverside. These are very low-lying areas right on the St. Johns River that are still closed, and they're closed indefinitely. People are tearing up carpets and redoing walls. If you go about a 45-minute drive south down the I-95, you'll hit, of course, the historic city of St. Augustine. And I had a chance to go through and talk to a lot of business owners who were close to the Matanzas River that also crested and flooded the historic downtown area. And there are some bars and restaurants there that they're not quite sure when they'll be able to reopen. A lot of very popular places. And of course, somewhere like St. Augustine relies very heavily on these tourism dollars. So understanding what effect Irma will have will probably mean waiting out, months and months from now to see what the lingering economic effects to the region will be.
And that part of the coast, that part of the state also took quite a bad hit from Matthew, if I'm remembering correctly. There's a lot of erosion along the roads there and some substantial flooding from that hurricane last year. So kind of a 1-2 punch, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. And almost like a 1-2-3 punch, because of course, what made Hurricane Irma especially difficult and especially dangerous was that the region was starting to get battered just a few hours before Irma made its way to the Northeast Florida region by a nor'easter coming south from the Northeast. And I believe the maximum gusts, not the sustained winds, but the gusts from that storm was already hitting at about 40 miles per hour, which a sustained wind of 40 miles per hour closes our bridges around here. And of course, those are vital arteries to get anywhere because we have so many different bodies of water, tributaries, and the St. Johns River. A lot of these places did get hit pretty hard with flooding during Matthew. And I spoke to actually multiple business owners who had just begun to dig out of the hole that Matthew had put them in, just started getting some of that FEMA relief and started buying new furniture and really getting back to normal when they were hit with Irma. So this is for a lot of these businesses, they're actually starting to wonder whether or not they should continue opening up shop where they are.
So what's your takeaway, Ryan Bink, from covering the storm? How do you think you'll approach the next big storm that comes through?
you know, there's not a whole lot that, you know, I think we would do differently here at WJCT. I think a lot of us would rethink about being home during the storm. There was a couple of us that were there sort of as auxiliary and, as I said, kind of reporting in from different areas of town. Our news director, Jessica Palumbo, was at the time, and she's even closer now, obviously, only about 2 weeks away from giving birth to her first son. And she had to be rescued from her neighborhood. She lived in the San Marco neighborhood where she was using her computer to do digital updates and edit scripts for other reporters. And she actually had to be rescued because the floodwaters had surrounded her house. And so I think we may double check our surroundings and our plans to ensure that we're places that are in a little bit of higher ground. But other than that, in terms of the coverage, I'm not really sure that we would do anything differently.
Ryan Benk is a reporter and host with WJCT in Jacksonville. Ryan, best of luck as you cover the ongoing recovery from the storm and as Jacksonville gets back up and running following Irma.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
Nobody can understand what to do. It's meaningless. It doesn't have any correlation to academic success.
Do you struggle to help your kids get their homework done after a long day at school? Well, Marion County Public School Superintendent Heidi Meyer feels your pain. She explains why the county has done away with traditional homework for elementary school kids. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. It's time now for a new segment on Intersection from the Education Desk. Well, for many parents and kids, homework can be a nightly struggle. Marion County Public Schools has taken the step of eliminating traditional homework for elementary school kids. Dr. Heidi Meyer is the superintendent of Marion County Schools. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. So talk me through the decision to end homework at Marion County's K-12 schools. What was the thought process behind this decision?
Well, this decision is for our elementary kids. So that's our pre-K through grade 5 students. And this decision was a very logical one based on substantial research, primarily by Dr. Richard Allington from University of Tennessee, that shows that the traditional type of homework that perhaps you and I had, I know I had it, where you do endless worksheets at night, the kind of homework that ends up creating discussions or, let's say, strife with the family unit because nobody can understand what to do. It's meaningless. It doesn't have any correlation to academic success. And that's what Dr. Allington's research showed, is that type of traditional homework does not result in student success. However, reading aloud with your family at night does show academic gains. And so that's why we made this decision to take away that traditional homework and instead replace it with the initiative to read with your family at least 20 minutes a night. Along with that, it is self-selected text, which means the student is choosing what to read. This is another way for the family to bond, where the family, the parents, the older siblings work with that child to choose a book that they want to read. So it's a way to not only bond through reading to increase academic achievement, but it's a way for families to share their values as they choose a book to read.
Now, did the families in Marion County have an inkling that this could be a possibility before you became superintendent? Had you kind of telegraphed that you had a plan to do something about the way homework was done in Marion County?
Before I became superintendent, it was not publicly shared. I was a professor at a local college, and I worked in the teacher preparation program. So I was teaching people who wanted to be teachers. And that's when we, as a class, as a cohort, discovered Dr. Allington's research. And it just made such logical sense from our side of the house with preparing future teachers and all of that research. And so to be able to put that into practice and see it really work with these kids was an exciting opportunity, and one that was, again, just a logical decision for us.
How long have those pre-K through grade 5 students in Marion County been doing the reading as opposed to the traditional homework? Did it start at the beginning of the school year?
It did, August. At the beginning of August when we started this school year. This is my administration's first full school year.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of feedback have you gotten from the kids so far?
At first, the kids were, as you would expect, oh, no homework, no homework. They were all excited about that. But then when it was explained to them and the excitement for them to be able to choose the books they want to read and to have that opportunity to not only read, but it frees them up to either have more family time or to go to extracurricular activities without that black cloud of all of that traditional homework hanging over their heads, it has increased their vestment in the process because they see that it gives them such autonomy. We've gotten great feedback from families as well who like it for the same reasons. But what is most exciting to me is that these families are saying, I have time with my kids. And the discussions that these families are having with their kids as they read. Because when you're reading a book, a storybook or a young adult novel, the language, the vocabulary in those books is such at a higher level than what we use when we speak to each other. Because, of course, you know, the author has to explain every little detail. So the vocabulary is so robust that we're seeing kids using larger words, more robust vocabulary. And again, it prompts such great discussions with the family unit. And that's what we're all about here, too, is empowering families to make great educational decisions for their kids.
I'm wondering, though, if you've heard from some parents who are a bit alarmed at the idea of not having homework along the lines of math or science or social studies to complement the reading. Have you heard from some parents who are saying, hang on a minute, we're not so sure about this?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did, especially in the beginning when we announced this initiative. And so opportunities like this to share our message are very much appreciated. But that feedback is important to us because it shows us we need to do a better job getting the information out to these families. And that's what we have done. We've created every opportunity to do outreach to families and to show why we're doing it.
What about other school districts then? Because my understanding is that Marion County is the only school district that has taken this approach to homework for the pre-K through grade 5 level so far. Are you hearing from other superintendents thinking that this might be a good move for their school district too?
We haven't heard directly from any superintendents. But I welcome the conversation with them. But honestly, this decision was made for our kids because that's my job, is to take care of our 43,000 kids. And so every decision we make here will be based on what's best for them. And this was what's best for our elementary kids.
And you talked about the research too, the research that kind of prompted this decision, and I guess your work training teachers as well. But what about other school districts in other parts of the country? Is there some field testing of this that's gone on elsewhere?
I have heard from some districts, particularly one in New York, the Patch Med School District with Dr. Michael Hines. He's the superintendent up there, and he actually is my idol. When I grow up, I want to be Dr. Michael Hines, and he's a great superintendent, and he and I have connected on Facebook, and we're keeping track of what each other's doing, and he does that as well up there. He also is a great proponent of recess for elementary, which we are too, so we're connecting with him, and through social media, Twitter and things, I've been contacted by the Commissioner of Education in Arkansas, who was very impressed with it, and just different entities like that. So,
and your teachers, what do they think of all this? Do they feel like they're missing out, or they don't have time to get through the, you know, it's a lot of work that they have to get through with these kids? Do they feel like they're missing out on some of that?
No, actually, it gives them more time now to teach. It gives them more time to teach because they don't have to worry about either grading this traditional type of homework that we know didn't show academic gains anyway. So they don't have to worry about that. There's not the struggle with students who couldn't do the homework because of life circumstances at home, or when you knew the family, the mom maybe was doing the homework after the child went to bed. So that has leveled the playing field much more for these kids. And again, it's that just encouraging that reading at home that these teachers are really enjoying. And I'm getting feedback from our teachers too that say these students are coming back to class using more robust vocabulary and having more ability to have conversations. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Do you think it's going to take some time before you start to see, like, kind of what the long-term or the real results down the track? When you talk about the sort of incremental vocabulary increase and the fact that teachers have a bit more time to teach as opposed to grading, etc., but do you really need to sort of wait a year or two to see what impact this has?
Well, absolutely. And the data that I shared with you, of course, has been we've been collecting since day one. But again, I'm excited to see at the end of the school year when we do our final assessments how it all turns out. And I'm feeling very positive. I know our teachers are teaching to the standards, to the depth of the standards. These kids are loving coming to school. They're reading. They're sharing with their families. The families are engaged. It's a perfect equation for success.
Heidi Mayer, you mentioned recess, and I feel as though homework, recess, and testing are kind of three things that schools and parents and teachers have been struggling with in the last little while. Are we at a moment of change here where schools are going to really radically rethink the way they approach these three kind of pillars of the education system?
Well, we are here in Marion County, I can tell you that. We know, again, that recess, there's research behind recess that shows it also helps with academic performance. The feedback, again, that we're getting from teachers is that it's calming their kids down to where they can focus in the classroom. We also have PE time, physical education time, which is standards-based. So we have that with recess, so our kids are moving up and moving so that they can then come back to the classroom and sit and learn. So again, great things are happening here, and it is a perfect time in Marion County Public Schools for this initiative to happen.
It is important, right? I mean, that is one thing that parents and teachers talk about, the idea of letting kids spend a bit of time away from the classroom to give their brains a rest.
Right. And we know, too, that it's that downtime where a child actually starts learning. When you have that downtime away from the academics and you're able to sit and process, that's when learning occurs. And as adults, you know, every so often we have to get up and just move around and walk around. It's unreasonable to expect a child to sit for that long and to be able to take in that information, process, and actually learn. So that, and then you mentioned assessment, too. In our district, at the end of last year, we suspended many assessments that we knew were not giving us accurate data to drive instruction, because that's the purpose of assessment, to not penalize a child, but to give data to that teacher to drive instruction. So we have rethought the way we do assessment. We are doing holistic performance-based assessments with all grades, particularly with elementary grades. And again, these three things, like you mentioned, just come together for the perfect equation for success for our kids.
Well, Dr. Heidi Mayer is the superintendent of Marion County Schools. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Have an awesome day.
Education reporting on 90.7 News is brought to you by Helios Education Foundation.
From the Education Desk airs every other Tuesday on Intersection. Still to come.
The whole time I was captured, I swore to myself that if I ever made it out of that place, I would try to be a better person and be more tolerant of other people's foibles and more patient.
Hal Kushner is one of nearly 100 people interviewed for the documentary series The Vietnam War, directed by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, and airing now on PBS. When Intersection returns, we'll revisit a conversation with Novick and Dr. Kushner. If you missed an episode of Intersection, you can find it on the WMFE app. You can also check out our podcast on iTunes and on the NPR One app. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. More than 58,000 Americans lost their lives in the Vietnam War. Estimates of the number of Vietnamese military and civilians who were killed range from 1.5 to 3.8 million. The Vietnam War is a new documentary from Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, airing now on PBS. It features interviews with nearly 100 people, including Americans who fought in the war, Americans who opposed it, Vietnamese soldiers from the North and South, and Vietnamese civilians. In May, we aired an interview with Novick and Dr. Hal Kushner, one of the veterans featured in the documentary. This is an encore presentation of that interview. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Our pleasure.
Hal, I want to start with you. You were shot down and captured. What led to your release?
The end of the war. The war ended in January of 1973, and then the POWs were released in sequence until the end of March 1973, and my release date was 16 March 1973.
How long were you in captivity?
From 2 December 1967 till 16 March 1973, 1,932 days.
Wow. That's a long time.
5.5 years.
How did that experience change you?
I hope it didn't change me. I became more aware of what a wonderful country I live in. I came back and had some medical problems. I was in the hospital for several months, and then I went back to duty in August of 1967. The whole time I was captured, I swore to myself that if I ever made it out of that place, I would try to be a better person and be more tolerant of other people's foibles and more patient, but I'm not.
Mm. Did it make you angry, like the fact that you were captured, your treatment?
Well, my treatment made me angry at the time, and I was certainly upset that 10 fine American soldiers and Marines died in my arms. Nearly 50% of our camp in the South died. But I'm not bitter about the experience. It was a war. I was in a war, and people die in wars. And I had the misfortune to be captured, something I never considered, but I had the good fortune to be alive and to be released, and I came home with no disability, and I've never had a flashback or a nightmare or any type of mental health problem, and so I feel like I'm lucky and I'm fortunate. I survived an airplane crash where three other people died, and that was actually my third aircraft crash, and I was the only survivor of the prison camp who was captured before 1968, the only survivor. So rather than being angry or bitter, I'm lucky and fortunate.
Just to clarify, too, you were a flight surgeon, Colonel Kushner, so in your time in the camp, you tried to help out your fellow prisoners with the skills you had?
Yes. I was a doctor. I am a doctor. Mm-hmm. I'm currently a practicing doctor. And when I was captured, I was forbidden by my captors from practicing medicine. And in fact, I was made the latrine orderly by my captors in an effort to humiliate me. And the other prisoners were forbidden from calling me captain, my rank at the time, or doc. But still, we managed to hoard what little medicine we had and distribute it at the proper time. And I was able to counsel my fellow prisoners about nutrition and hygiene and sanitation. And occasionally was able to perform minor surgery with rusty razor blades or whatever tools were available, and help my fellow prisoners with my medical knowledge.
Were you worried about getting found out by the prison guards?
Well, once in a while I was found out because we had a turncoat in our midst who actually turned me in, and we had various punishments, being tied up or shackled or beaten. But that was part of my responsibility, I think, and I wasn't terribly worried about that, no.
Lynn Novick, what do stories like Hell's tell you about the Vietnam War that we didn't know before?
Wow. Well, there are so many ways to answer that question, because making this film has been a revelation for me and for Ken Burns and for our whole team in trying to get our arms around this enormously complicated story and very painful chapter in American history and in Vietnamese history. And I think one of the things that we take away from this experience for us as filmmakers is that the Vietnam War is a tragedy. You know, as you said, millions of people were killed, including 58,000 Americans and untold numbers of Vietnamese. It's hard to find a lot of positive uplift in this story. For us, the most redeeming aspect of making the film has been to hear the testimony of extraordinary people like Hal Kushner, who are willing to tell us what happened to them and to help us understand this extraordinarily difficult experience that they went through. And there's incredible courage and dignity and resilience in just the act of telling your story, which I felt once again just listening to Hal speak just now. It's very hard to convey how horrific the conditions were that he was kept in. I think for most Americans, they know about the Hanoi Hilton. We've heard a lot about that, and there's many stories that are more familiar than his experience being kept in camps in South Vietnam by the Viet Cong in indescribably terrible conditions, and how they endured and survived and kept their strength and their patriotism and their dedication and resilience and hope alive all through that time is just remarkable, absolutely remarkable, and very inspiring and very heroic.
What's a story that stands out for you, Lynn, from your conversations with some of the Vietnamese survivors of the war?
Well, we made an effort in making the film to speak to as many people as we could with many different points of view. So we have Americans who fought in the war and Americans who fought against the war. And we especially wanted to honor the American servicemen and soldiers who served and to commemorate their sacrifice. But we also wanted to not make the mistake that Americans often make, which is thinking that the Vietnam War is purely an American experience. So I went to Vietnam multiple times and spoke to many Vietnamese Americans here as well. And one of the things that really struck me was that we Americans, I think, are pretty well aware that the Vietnam War is a very difficult chapter for us, and we don't like to talk about it, and people get upset and are still very, it's very raw here. But it turns out that for the Vietnamese, it's very painful and difficult and divisive as well. And that was a revelation. And yet when you scratch the surface and we ask people to tell us just what was the war like, what happened to you, what happened to your family, how did you survive it, what do you think about it now, there's some profound human truths about what happens in war, which is, as Hal was just saying, it was a war. Terrible things happen. People do incredibly brave things. People suffer. People find a way to go forward. That was true in Vietnam and for the Vietnamese as well.
Mm-hmm. Why now then? Why did you decide that now is the time to make this series?
We feel very strongly that the Vietnam War is an extraordinarily important moment in American history, but it's also a moment that we don't know much about as a country, don't understand. There's sort of an amnesia about
why,
it.
Why is that?
So I would be curious to hear what Hal has to say about this too, because I think it was painful. We didn't win. It didn't go the way we wanted. There's a lot of bad feeling and recrimination and disappointment and pain and loss. And there's also a lot of, I don't want to say finger pointing, but recrimination about why did this happen?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we just haven't been able to work our way through that.
Hal Kushner, do you get that sense too? Is there a kind of collective amnesia in the United States about the Vietnam War?
Not for the people that served in it, but for the people who didn't, yes. Not much is known. We were at the VFW hall this morning, and I was asked a similar question. And I answered by saying that I'm a physician now. I see a lot of children, high school kids, in my practice, college kids. And the war is as remote to them as the revolution of the War of 1812. They're not taught it. They don't think about it. And it was not a good war, World War II was a good war. The soldiers came home. There were parades and confetti. And people like my father, their service was honored. And Vietnam vets came home and they were not honored. And so I think the collective conscious was just to put it behind us and move on. I remember President Ford declared the era of the Vietnam War is over. And President Carter declared a universal amnesty. And it was all, except for the MIA question, it tended to be forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily forgotten, but just put behind us, and we moved on.
I think it was almost sort of like swept under the rug or something, or we tried to forget it, but you can't forget something as traumatic and difficult. And the country was really bitterly divided during the war. So I
changed the culture of the whole country.
Exactly.
And the attitude toward the government of all the people.
Yeah, we haven't gotten past that.
What kind of response did you get from folks when you came back?
Wonderful response. I was a POW. I came back on 16 March 1973 to the Philippines. I was in the Philippines for 3 or 4 days and then back to the United States. My hometown, Danville, Virginia, had a big day for me with a parade, and school was out, and thousands of people came to the airport. And I was given an automobile by the Oldsmobile dealer, and my wife was living in a small house in Danville, Virginia, with my two children. And I remember one day after being home about a week, I went out to the mailbox to get my mail, and there was 4 steaks stuffed in the mailbox with no note. It was very moving.
I think, you know, the whole country was focused on the prisoners of war for a number of years. When are they going to come home? And when they finally did come home, it was such a national relief that they had been brought back. The whole country really rallied around all of them in a really beautiful way. But before that, many other American soldiers had come home. They were the last ones to come home. Mm-hmm. So many years of people coming home just after their year of service, and as the war wound down, they didn't have that kind of welcome home at all.
Colonel Kushner, what kind of communication did you have, if any, with your family back home while you were
none.
A captive?
None. I was captured on 2 December 1967. On the 8th or 9th of January 1968, two prisoners were released, two American prisoners who were Puerto Rican were released. And when they came back, they told the authorities that I was alive. In fact, I shook hands with one of them, and in his hand I pressed a piece of paper that had the names, ranks, and serial number of all of the prisoners in our camp. And my father actually was called to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and he identified my handwriting on that scrap of paper. So they knew I was alive then. Then that was January 68. Then in November 69, 3 other American prisoners were released. They brought word of my being alive. Then it wasn't until, I think, 1972, they knew there was information that I was alive. As I said this morning, my wife was pregnant when I left to go to Vietnam in August of 1967. And in April of 1968, she had a child, and that son, Michael, is now 49, lives in Orlando, and I didn't know he was born. I didn't know he was a boy. I didn't know anything about him until very close to the end of the war in late 72.
You talked before about that there's kind of a knowledge gap for folks who didn't experience the war like you did. Who do you want to see this, and what do you hope for them to get out of it?
That's a very far-reaching question. And I would like everybody to see the movie. I would like everybody of all age groups. And I think the movie is being distributed to schools, I heard this morning, and I think that's a wonderful thing. It's very long. It's 18 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's feasible for kids in school to watch 18 hours of movie. They're going to miss some reading, writing, and arithmetic if they do. But I would like for them to see certain parts of the movie. And I think the general population, I mean, all young adults and adults should see the movie. and be exposed to it. It's a critical part of our history, and it is one of the reasons we are the nation we are today. It really did. The Vietnam War changed the whole culture of the United States and our people's attitude toward their government.
Was that a change for the better?
I don't think so. No. I certainly don't think so. People lost their trust and faith in the government. When I went to Vietnam, 1967, and the year before when I was an intern in an Army hospital in Hawaii, there was not much divisiveness then. I mean, we all thought, of course, I was in a certain island of people who were in the military, but when I was in medical school back in Richmond, we all thought it was the right thing to do. It was a just war. I never questioned it whatsoever. I wouldn't. I mean, and she is exactly right. The attitude of the country and of the military within the country changed year by year. There were turning points, but it changed year by year. And at the end, we were a different country than we were at the beginning.
Lynn Novick, do you feel, having spent, you know, a decade on this project, now you're seeing it come to completion, it's going to be released and aired on PBS across the country in September.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you understand the war better?
I certainly feel I understand the war better. It has been an incredible education. And that's true for pretty much any project I've had the privilege of working on with Ken and Jeff and with our other team, is that we start off with something not knowing that much about it. And so by the time it's over, we have become quite well-versed in the story that we're trying to tell. That being said, I mean, if I could take you to our office in New York and show you all the books on our shelf about the Vietnam War and every aspect of it, it's overwhelming. It is an overwhelmingly complex story. And so I look forward to the fact that probably, you know, 20 years from now, somebody else can come along and make a different film about the subject, because there will be new information. There's no way to have the definitive final word on this story or this event. But at least for me, I feel I've gotten a much deeper understanding of what happened to our country and why we are the way we are, and just what Hal was saying about how divided we are and how little trust we have for each other and for our institutions. And, you know, I've listened a lot to the tapes of our leaders talking about the war while it was happening, which is one of the revelations of this project for all of us who worked on it. And they don't seem to quite know what to do sometimes. They're wrestling with a very gnarly problem that we have gotten ourselves into for good reason, but still, it doesn't seem to be willing to give in to their will. They are not able to fix it. And hearing Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon and their associates, their advisors, their closest confidants sort of agonize about this in different ways at different times gave me a newfound understanding of how hard it is to be the leader of the free world, and how, you know, there are problems that maybe don't have solutions. And that's a profound question that I would never have said before working on this project. I think I assumed, like most Americans, that we can fix anything. And that if we set our mind to it, we can solve this problem or that problem. It's possible that the Vietnam War shows us that that's not always true.
Well, Lynn Novick is the director, along with Ken Burns, of a new documentary series that's airing on PBS in September, The Vietnam War. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
We're also joined by Colonel Hal Kushner. He is part of the documentary series. Thank you so much, Colonel Kushner.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is brought to you by the Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Alana Campbell. Production assistant for this week's show from Abe Abaraya. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter @Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.